Dirty hands means clean theology. Can you dig it?
What is going on, all my local guys and gals? And long distance pals. Hey, we ain't forgot about you.
We are back. Yes, indeed. We are. I'm excited. I'm excited today. We're down the part-timer today, but we have a special guest with us today. It'll be pretty fun.
I'm excited because Steve actually is kind of taking over the guests and stuff this season. So I kind of find out, you know, like a couple days before. And when he told me about this guest, I kind of perked up. I'm like, oh, yeah, I know this guy. I talked to this guy. I'm ready to go, man.
It'll be good. It'll be good. Yeah, I'm excited, man. So let's start kicking things off right away, Justin. Why don't you jump into prayer for us, and we'll see where this journey takes us.
Yeah. Dear kind and gracious Heavenly Father, thank you for today. Thank you for the many blessings that you've given us. Thank you for the opportunity to dive into your word and seek out these treasures that you've left behind for us that like to seek, Father. And we thank you for this guest today, and we thank you for his endurance to push forward and dive through your word and seek out some of these gold nuggets, as we like to say, and taking the time to go on these shows and stuff and share his treasures with us, Father. We're just so thankful for that. We just pray a blessing over the broadcast today, and we pray that whoever is listening, the person that needs to hear this, to reestablish their faith, give them a firm foundation to stand on and to witness to the world, Father. We pray that these people find this show and that they find it enlightening and that they use this to edify your name, Father. In Jesus' name we pray, amen.
Amen. Absolutely love it. A lot of you guys out there, I know you do the same thing I do, where you mindlessly jump on Facebook or one of these things and you just start doom scrolling through the videos, through the reels, and you see all sorts of things, and all of a sudden something catches your attention. Well, that's what happened to me in this exact situation, and I started watching reel after reel, and I'm like, I have to reach out to this guy because he was blowing my mind. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce John Adolfi from the Lost World Museum. Thank you so much, John, for being a part of the show. I know Justin's excited. I know I am, especially after everything we talked about.
Sure.
Buddy, I am just super glad you're here with us.
And thank you. And thank you for reaching out to me and asking me to come on. It's always a pleasure to be able to get on people's show and just talk and see what's up. And like you said in your prayer, you never know who's going to stumble on this podcast or vlog and, you know, and be able to, you know, be inspired by something that one of us says, you know. Love it.
I absolutely agree. Now, we talked a little bit the other day. You have quite a collection of different things and some artifacts, some things of this nature that I find kind of fascinating. You bring some of this stuff up when you're going over some of your reels, some of the videos that you put out, things of that nature. And it's something that's near and dear to my heart, and it's something that we've really been focusing on lately because we are actually starting to shoot a documentary on the creation versus evolution type thing. So I love finding someone that is passionate about that and has some insight and some things that they'd like to show to kind of further you know, people's understanding about how creation is it just makes sense. So John, I know you have a few of these things. I know you want to show us a few things, and I'm excited.
Just for those out there, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say too, before you get too deep into it, for those that don't, you know about you, kind of just give everybody a feel of, you know, what your channel is, what you do, kind of how you got into it, and kind of give everybody a little feel for you.
I'll give you the 45-second version. So I was in the Navy, and in 84, I had an experience on board my ship, and basically my conscious mind at the time, that's what I thought it was, asked the question in so many words, is it Adam or is it ape? Because we'd like to ask the provocative, important question, is it apes, aliens, or Adam? We throw the aliens in there, too, because that's a theory that some people ascribe to. And I came to the conclusion, as a ex-Catholic agnostic, I came to the conclusion, like, instantly, that it had to be Adam, or the Bible was inspired, because the alternative, when I actually thought about it, the end result of that idea that there is no God, and that, and it's not like I was thinking in terms of evolution, but there's no God, you know, there's no God. And I was horrified, to be honest with you. Now, you understand, I wasn't like, you know, this is going to be longer than 45 seconds. I wasn't going to, well, this is my testimony in a sense, because, you know, I was just kind of floating along. I didn't have a bad life. Nothing. I wasn't looking to be a Christian or anything like that. None whatsoever. I was perfectly happy where I was at. And but truth demanded an answer. And when I looked at the idea of nothing brought this about and there was nothing beyond death, I was horrified how depressing, hopeless, and dark that was. And I didn't really... You know, I mean, you don't talk about that in science class. You don't talk about the philosophical implications of evolution from the standpoint of, as the Bible says, that God has put eternity in our hearts. This is something that's naturally born. Now, you may have some tough times, want to think of ending your life, or you just, you know, are you really tired about life or whatever? I get that. But when you're physically and mentally and emotionally in a right place, you don't want to die. Nobody really does, you know, for the most part. So that started my journey, and I wound up taking a Revelation seminar, and I ended up being baptized a Seventh-day Adventist. Now, I'm not a flag waver, but let me just say this that I found out to be very, very interesting, and that is when I was down at the Creation Evidence Museum in Glen Rose, Texas, it's a hotbed for young earth creationists to hang out at. It's just a wonderful place. And I kept hearing about other Christians who are into young earth creationism going back to their churches, really not just because they heard it once, but they're really studied in this. And they really felt a burden to be able to share this with their church, and their churches are rejecting it. They're thinking they're kind of like off in left field, like they're some conspiracy person, or this is just unnecessary for the Christian knowledge and experience. And I couldn't understand why, because in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, everybody is a young earth creationist, without exception. I'm not, you know, maybe I'm being a little bit hyperbole there, but, you know, but I'm finding that within the Protestant churches, forget about the Catholic Church, you know, they embrace evolution. Within the Protestant churches, they're not all young earth creationists. They're either agnostic about the subject, or they're old earth creationists, or they have no interest in it, or they are against it. I'm like, what? It took me a while to piece this together. I didn't read this anywhere. I had to piece this together based on the... So you guys being enamored with this is really, really cool. For where I came from, I think everybody should be a young earth creationist without exception. Because it's right. And there are people out there, skeptics or people who are not really sure about it or whatever, not people who have a big chip on their shoulder, but people who are genuinely questioning. And there's some in a minority out there, as far as I can tell, as far as those who are vocal in the comment section on the various platforms. And and to your question or statement, hi, I'm John Adolfi with the Lost World Museum, and you can find us on TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, Threads, X, and especially Facebook. So, and we just started doing LinkedIn again, but so there you have it. We're more of an online than we are a physical location. I do have a small physical location that is a window display only right next to my real estate office in the Village of Phoenix in New York, Central New York, right near Syracuse. And but right now, all these artifacts that we buy that could very well go into a museum and fill a small museum are right now being paraded online. So there's my introduction.
Love it. Love it. That was a great 45-second introduction. It was beautiful.
Thank you.
Beautiful.
We transcended time, space, and matter, as we Kent sure Hovind would like to say.
We sure did.
He even sounded like Kenny's like, I'm just right.
That, man. 10-1.
I'm just right.
Yeah, that was the now, thing. My favorite thing he ever said, Kent said. He goes, I don't argue. I'm just right.
Yeah, I'm just right.
He's so funny. He's smart enough to be able to say that, too. I'll tell you.
Yeah.
He is such a real, he's so entertaining and so cool. I've got a bunch of things with me here today. I'm going to parade them across the screen. I'll talk a little bit about each of them and what it is that supports this idea. Let me set it up that the earth, life on earth, fossils on the earth, the geology on the earth that we see, is 6,000 years according to Genesis. Now, the age of the earth, the actual granite and water that was here when God started to speak light into existence and then started to go in, and by the way, those are 24-hour periods. A yom in the Hebrew is 24 hours. These are 24-hour periods, and it was somewhere around 6,000 years ago that Jesus was the one who spoke these things into existence. The Father said, go, and Jesus said, that's what I do best, and he spoke everything into existence, and everything is sustained by the power of his word. That's the reason why creationism is important, because if you undermine this idea that he cannot speak with his word instantaneously, then when he said to the man with the withered hand, stretch forth your hand, he shouldn't have been able to heal his hand then. Because it's the same exact action that's taking place. And when Peter said, hey, command me, say the word, command me to walk on the water, he wouldn't get on the water until he actually asked him to speak the word, same word in creation. It's the same word that gave Peter the ability to walk on water. So when we get to the gospel and he says, be ye perfect as your Father is perfect, he's giving a command. He's speaking his word again. And the challenge is to embrace that so that it's so. Not pretend, not erasing sins on the board, which does happen, but actually to be able to walk on the water. That's the reason why creationism, young earth creationism, is so important, because there's a continuity from the time that he says, let the earth bring forth grass on day 3 to when he says, be perfect. It's the same exact dynamic. And do you know who actually picked up on that early on? Was the centurion. He understood that. It's a mind-blowing concept. So the idea is that 6,000 years, Adam and Eve, after 6 days of creation, Adam and Eve were created on the sixth day. And then on the seventh, they rested. And that 1,600 years later, because of sin, rebellion, there was a worldwide flood, and all of the fossil record that we see, almost all of it, and all of the strata that we see, almost all of it, and the oceans that we experience are all as a result of the worldwide flood or the aftermath of it. So when we look at history, it's in the context of 6,000 years, and for the most part, 4,400 years post-flood is where we really pick things back up. Everything else was just wiped out. All we really have from the antediluvian world is strata and fossils. That's it. I don't know if there's any structures that have ever been found. Maybe there have, that were pre-flood. I mean, everything got wiped out pretty good. So what I'm looking for when I look at geology, when I look at formation of rock and how quickly or how slowly that takes place, the formation of fossils, how quickly or slowly in nature, in the lab, in order to try to replicate the pre-flood or the flood conditions, you know, I'm looking at rapid rock formation, rapid fossilization, and giant humans as well, too. The assumption is that people before the flood had a higher IQ, lived to be 900 years, and were much larger and much more robust than we are today. That's my understanding of young earth creationism. And yes, the Nephilim were 100% human. And I don't know why more people don't at least examine that theory, because everybody in Christendom, including Judaism embraces this idea of angel-human amalgamation or hybridization. And there is another theory out there that I personally subscribe to that isn't weird. There's no angel blood in these people. And even if they did have angel blood, evil angel blood, it doesn't make their heart any less evil. It's all about the mind and the decision to do or to say or to think. You know, that's where sin is cultivated, you know? All right. So what evidences do we have? Well, let's go ahead and kick right into, and I'm not facetious about these things or vindictive, but the dating methods is what they all, everything rises and falls on the dating methods. Carbon dating for up to, according to evolution, and I'll when I use millions of years or hundreds of thousands of years, I'll try to preface it, but we're talking about the evolution theory. Yep, there you go. There's these lava rocks. Okay. And I have a certificate of authenticity right here. Let me just read it. This is to certify that the rock from, and I cannot pronounce this, Keopiliu in Hawaii, mm-hmm. was dated by three independent groups. Test number one, scientists dated the rock using the potassium argon method. They came up with an age of 1 to 2.4 billion years. Okay. Scientists dated the rock via helium radiometric method, came up with 140 to 670 million years. Well, we'll stop right there and you would say, why do we have a span of 140 million years to 2.4 billion years? And you could give this the mathematical percentage of how much difference there is between that and have to scratch your head. But the islanders watched this rock form in the eruption in 1801. This is only 200 years old. Now, this is just one example. And some would say, well, that, you know, just because you got one example of something like that doesn't mean anything. Okay, that's fine. That's fine. So the question then is, when we see something like this, this was taken from Glen Rose, Texas. This was taken by evolutionary paleontologists. When the river was dry, they went in and they did castings, and then just so happens that this was for sale at the Dinosaur Valley State Park in Glen Rose. And they had three of them on the wall, and they were there just for one day, and we snatched all three of them. This is the smallest of the three. This is an Acrocanthosaurus. Now, this is in limestone. And the limestone, they did a nice job of painting this, the color, approximate color of what limestone looks like. It's absolutely gorgeous when it's wet. It's flat. And when we're scraping the mud off, looking for dinosaur tracks, it just glistens in the sun. It's just gorgeous. But this is limestone. Now, limestone, there's a large range for limestone, but the Cretaceous limestone pigeonholes it between 65 million years and 140 million years. And in Glen Rose, they have assigned it to be somewhere in the neighborhood of 100 to 108 million years. Okay. Cretaceous limestone. In 1964, in the Pluxey River in Glen Rose, where that dinosaur footprint was found, and this is a second-generation replica, and I'll explain in just a second the history behind this. This was found. This is called the Caldwell Track. Billy Caldwell, who is a geologist, young Earth creationist geologist, some men who were taking up limestone from the area, you know, to resell, saw this in the river. They saw this in the river, and it took them a couple of weeks to get it out because they didn't want it to break. And it was heavy. It was hundreds of pounds, Billy told me. Billy's still alive. He's 92 years old. And I actually interviewed him and videoed the interview of the story behind this. So they bring it to his shop and they say, here, we just want to let you know we found this in the Pluxey River while we were quarrying. And he examined it, obviously. And then in 1964, 65, this ended up being purchased by a wealthy oil man from Texas. And he took it to the World's Fair in New York and put it on display in the Sinclair exhibit.
Hey guys, this is Steve from the Dig Bible Podcast. I really hope you guys are enjoying the content, but also the sound quality. It's drastically improved since I handed that duty over to the handcrafted audio. If you've enjoyed the quality of the show and have any audio or editing needs, reach out to Jason at thehandcraftedaudio@gmail.com. And as always, keep digging.
Sinclair is that green dinosaur. Are mm-hmm. you familiar with that? Sinclair
Oil Company.
Yeah.
Fuel dead so dinosaurs. They had this on
yeah. Yeah. So they
that
had
thing
this on
is
display.
Huge, man. It looks like it's as big as your torso.
So it's approximately 16 inches. The biggest criticism about this is that the footprint is just so perfect. Now, let me tell you what happened. Before he sold this to the oil man, that is the guy who actually found it, not Billy. Billy would love to have kept it. But Billy told me that before that happened, he took a concrete cast of it. He didn't do it in plaster, he did it in concrete. And I have often wondered, before I met Billy, which was last year, how close this is to at least the concrete cast. We don't have the original anymore. It disappeared after probably the oil man collected it, and it's probably sitting underneath a bed somewhere or thrown out. Who knows? But I wanted to see how close this was to the first generation. And I had the opportunity because it was there over in a corner somewhere at the Glen Rose Museum. He had donated it to Carl Baugh. And I took this and I sat it right down next to it on the floor. Nobody else really cared. I'm like geeking out like crazy. And nobody was like, you know, because this wasn't even on display. It was just sitting on another fossil over there, you know, in two pieces. He had dropped it. So it broke in two. Oh. And I put this next to it and I photographed it and I videoed it. I haven't released it. And it was almost perfect. Like almost you couldn't tell the difference. So what I have is almost carbon copy to what he had, which I'm assuming that is just about carbon copy of what the original was. So now we have a human footprint, a giant human footprint in Cretaceous limestone. Drop the mic. Critics say that this is a fraud. It was carved, or he's lying.
Isn't there always an excuse, right? There's always something, and it'll come down to, well, it's made up. Well, it's just something fabricated. Oh, it just drives me nuts. But you keep coming one more arrow after another arrow, just another dart in that evolutionary theory, one after another.
Yeah, the giant bones, you know, the people didn't know how to measure, or the giant depictions in art and on cave walls. Oh, well, they had really crappy depth perception. I mean, they always have an excuse.
Let me tell you, the enemy of evolution, the enemy of the Smithsonian, is two things. Giant humans and Noah's Ark. Now, you got to understand, in Christianity in America in the 1800s, there was an association with giant humans and Genesis. Not angel humans, but giant humans and Genesis. There are about 40 minutes south of me, there is a place called Cardiff, New York. It's just south of Syracuse. And in the 1850s, 60s, time that P.T. Barnum was in full swing. They 1869, they were digging for some wells on somebody's farm, and they found this 10-foot-2 petrified man in the ground. It was a hoax. This was dreamed up a year before, and it was, they got some gypsum out of It was Fort Dodge, Iowa, and they hauled it all the way back to Syracuse, and they chipped this thing and made it look like a human, and they buried it. And the hoax was to make money and also to poke fun at Christians. The guy that did it hated Christianity, hated the Bible. And this was the one way that he could exemplify and tell them, ha ha, fooled you, idiot, with creating a giant human from the pages of Genesis. He was hoping everybody would jump on and just immediately identify it with that, but they didn't. Some said it was a statue that people worshipped. Others said that it was a petrified man. Others said that it was a hoax. I mean, there were too many opinions on it, but enough curiosity that some people made some serious money. So another thing I don't have on me, I do have it downstairs, is that in the Plexi River, a giant cat, whether it be saber-tooth or American lion, was found in the same Cretaceous limestone. And the original, not a cast, which is what I have, the original is at the Creation Evidence Museum in Glen Rose, Texas. So now you have a dinosaur, a large cat, and a human in the same relative strata of Cretaceous limestone.
That's crazy.
So you either have to dismiss one or more of those some way, somehow, or it was either during or shortly after the worldwide flood that all this was laid down. Probably during.
It's crazy because you look at the same kind of thing when you go to like the Grand Canyon, right? And you see the layers, the way that the sediment lays, and everything's so perfect, right? The layer upon layer, the way the sediment would have laid when the flood was happening. So you get a sediment layer of something heavier here, and the next layer comes here, and everything's so perfectly level. You know, if it was something over time, you would have erosion. You would have things that jut out. You would have all these different changes in each layer of that strata. But instead, it's that perfect layer. Same thing when you find those fossils just like that, all in that same layer. It just points back to the same thing.
You know, recently they discovered that white sands. Where is that? New Mexico?
Yeah.
I seen it on that Graham Hancock Ancient Apocalypse. The new one that they were finding, like you were saying, all these ancient extinct creature footprints, but alongside of them, human footprints.
Yeah. They also had giant human footprints in white sands that are no longer there. Those footprints really do come and go, not come, but they do get eroded really quick because of the either wind or water action. There's more to it than that. There's something else that breaks it down, and I can't remember what it was. But I remember when I was in Yuma, Arizona, I was at a library and got a book that referenced various things like you're talking about. And in White Sands, and I'm not sure exactly when, but it was in, you know, like from somewhere between 1940 to 1980, whatever, somewhere in there, they found 23-inch human footprints with an 8-inch width at the ball of the foot that had strides that suggested that the person was, you know, 11, 12 feet tall. And Glen Rose, they had the same thing. But now, of course, they'll tell you that those are just eroded dinosaurs, a certain type of dinosaur footprint that parts of it were eroded. Well, how come the dinosaur print next to it isn't eroded any differently than the one that you're saying is that looks like a human footprint, but you're saying is a dinosaur print? I talked to a lady, her name is Beverly Birrell, and Beverly gave me all of her father's research from the Plexi River in the 1970s. She sent me 400 slides and photos and Super 8 film from that era when they were damming it up and looking for tracks. And there was at least a half a dozen or more giant human footprints. Now, I didn't have the luxury of being able to be there to see them. I saw the photos, and you certainly could surmise that they were. But you know what she told me? She said, John, she was a teenager or whatever at the time. I saw them up close. Those were human. You could see that the toes and everything. There was human, she said. There was no mistaking it. Nothing like an eyewitness report that people like to dismiss, but you know.
Last time we talked, you said that you had access to a book that went out of print, and it involved giants and some footprints, and that you were in the process of getting the rights to republish it. Is this right. the same thing you're talking about,
it's or
is
called
it, am I thinking of something different?
No. Giants Against Evolution by Joe Taylor. Joe passed away, and before he passed away, he gave me the ability to at least sell the digital versions of it. We haven't approached anyone, if there is anyone, regarding the actual, you know, actually printing it, you know. Wait a minute. That's not it. You're talking about Valley of the Giants and Giant Mantra.
Yes.
Valley of the Giants by C.N. Doherty is quite a famous within the realm of people that look into this stuff. It's a very famous book. Valley of the Giants. Carl Baugh ended up with the rights to it, believe it or not. And I called up Carl after I found that out, and I said, hey, Carl, can I reprint this? I mean, redo it really well. I mean, I want to just retypeset it. I want to AI the photos. He goes, do it. So that's what we did. And the photos were a little better. And I was very pleased with what we did. But then Beverly Birrell came out of the woodwork, and she said, my dad did a book called, who knew C.N. Doherty, they were good friends, called Giant Mantrax. I'm like going, ooh. So she sent me the book, and then we made arrangements to get all of her dad's stuff. Now, the reason why that was so important is because I wanted to retypeset his book too, Giant Mantrax. And she said, yeah, sure, go for it. So I did. And then all of those 400 slides, I went through every single one and scanned every single one to look for the photos in the book that we could replace with color 35 millimeter digital scans. I'm almost getting goosebumps just saying that.
That's cool.
It really is. We got about 75% of the photos replaced with the new ones.
That's awesome.
And so that book has got very clear photos, as opposed to the Valley of the Giants is good, but this is even better as far as clarity. If anybody cares, I'm just saying that's.
Yeah. When can we get our hands on these?
That's what I'm wondering.
They're right on my site.
Well, Lost there World you go. Museum. All right. I'll see you guys later. I'm going to go order a book.
That'll be You'll my Christmas present to myself.
There you go.
Okay. Listen, not that this is a commercial. Okay. But you know what we did? We also scanned them digitally. Okay. Both of those books. And of course we had the Giants Against Evolution already scanned, you know. We sell all three of those as a bundle for like $39 or something like that.
Wow.
So if you like digital, you know, have at it. Most people on Amazon, when they order it, always order the paper. Paper still triumphs.
I prefer to have a solid copy, to be honest with you.
I hear you. I do too.
And I think I retain better on that too. Plus, I like taking notes, highlighting, writing the margins.
I have my research library.
Yep.
My reference library.
You can look behind me. There's some of it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you do, if anybody out there does get, you know, Giants Against Evolution and they want to have it, you know, go down to Staples and have it printed and bound, nobody's going to stop them. Okay. So
enough.
A little extra expense, but let me show you something else I got here. This right here, is purported to be a giant, limestone finger. This again was found, down in the Glen Rose area. Now, it's interesting, and when I first saw this, I thought, let me get real close with this. Hold on one second. Okay. Let's see if that'll help.
Mm-hmm.
I thought to myself, and here's what it looks, here's the actual finger right there. I thought, okay. It's not a fossil. I mean, a fossil in the sense that it's it left an impression in the ground, or, you know, it's there. You know, every once in a while, I've got a fish fossil where it's in the entire fish. It's not, it's squished and, but in beautiful condition, you know, the bones and stuff. It's, you know, the entire fish is fossilized. This would fall into that category. And even worms, here's a fossil worm right there. So soft body can fossilize. But when I first saw this, I'm thinking, it could be a natural formation. You know what I mean? I mean, come on. So they did a CT scan, and sure enough, it's denser in the middle where the bone would be. Okay. Crime scene investigation. We got to be fair about this. And then what they did was they cut it. They cut it just like that. Actually, in two spots. You'll see that right up at the top. And this may not be apparent, but, and I'll just kind of, they feel that this right here is bone marrow. They feel right on the edge is skin. And extensor tendons. They believe some of these are tendons.
That's nuts.
Now, of course, somebody say, of course you're seeing that. You're a young earth creationist. You're going to see that. You know, I'll tell you something. Yes, young earth creationists are gullible. And yes, I'm sure that, you know, I see something in that rock that really isn't there, you know, hopeful and everything, because it just seems like evolution wins just too often. And they do. They do. They win. They're not right, but they've got the money. They've got 200 years of some of the most brilliant minds putting all this together. They have a cause and effect for everything, it seems.
And they have time on their side, right? Because that's the ultimate factor for them.
That's right. They got billions of years, hundreds of millions of years. So let's talk about fossil formation. I'm going to show you a gadget. I'm going to lift it because it's just going to happen. Hold on. This is what I bought this thing for.
Bare desk.
I affectionately call this the Franken fossil maker. Because it looks like something that you would have in a laboratory.
Mm-hmm.
These come off. This plate comes off. And in this tube, you put clay. I'll just simplify it. You put clay and some screens and some organic matter like a leaf, and then you compress it to a certain PSI equivalent, and then you stick it in the oven 400 some odd degrees for 12 hours. And what he's trying to do, the inventor of this, he's trying to figure out what causes a fossil to fossilize, and could that also be replicating the conditions during the flood, i.e. the amount of overburden that's creating the amount of pressure necessary for it. And what I've found out is the amount of overburden in many cases is very, very tremendous to do some of this. So you take a leaf and you put it in the fossil maker. And after, you know, 24 hours from the time that you stick it in there and in the oven, and then take it out and let it cool down, this is what happens.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah. Now critics will sit there and say, that's just, I don't know if they say carbonized or something, whatever. There's always that. And then, you know, some other leaves that he had. So he can stack this stuff when he puts it in that tube or the cylinder. And then I'll show you one more. Maybe you can try to guess this one.
Is that coral?
It's a squid.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I saw the little suction cups. I was looked like a little piece of coral or something. But yeah, I see that.
Yeah.
I was about to say a pot leaf. I thought we were still in the plants.
And you know, that's a fossil, man. That right there, it's not like it's been impressed or burned in or whatever.
No.
That is a fossil. How long did it take? 24 hours. So how long do fossils take to make? Well, when you bring this up, they say, well, of course some fossilization takes place quickly. Dummy. That's what they say. And it's like, well, apparently you haven't done your job, because the majority of people out there believe that not only are fossils old, but it takes a long, 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 long time for them to form. So you haven't really done a good job, at least to be fair about it. Whatever.
So question being, say you were to take that. I know you made it 24 hours ago. Say you did that. You were to take that and do a carbon dating test on it. What would it tell you?
I don't know. That's a great question. Takes about $500 to find out.
Yeah, well, we'll have to.
Maybe we can do that.
That would be interesting, just to see the range it would give
you. According to how deep you dug to get the clay.
And I mean, I really don't know. And I say that just kind of, I guess, as that would be some pretty interesting evidence to throw into the hat there. You know what I mean?
I agree. That's a fantastic idea. It really is. And
then you have that place in Europe that's got that natural mineral deposit that you can send teddy bears or hats or whatever to and pay a fee. And it just, that mineral water drips on it and it makes a fossil just in a few days or weeks. Yeah.
Yep. I've seen. Yes, exactly. I've seen that.
That's called wild. Mother Shipton. Yeah. And, that was 5 months, I believe.
Yeah.
Was it one of your reels that I saw a hat, like a top hat on, that had done that?
A fedora, yeah.
Yeah, fedora. Yeah. That's unbelievable.
Yeah. And for those that's having trouble seeing, this is like a waterfall and like a cave entrance, and they take a string, and whatever item you send them, they tie it to this string, and that water just drips over it for a certain amount of time.
It's just the mineral deposits that they say take millions and millions of years.
No, it's yeah. And again, they sit there and they try to correct me by saying, no. We know that, you know, depending on the density of the material and how fast the water flow is and the temperature and all of that, we know that it can form things quickly. Well, apparently you haven't put the word out there, because nobody knows that. And that's what you would expect to see or be able to replicate in the lab or in nature, if you can find it in nature, of a young Earth. That's what you would see. That's what you would find. I don't see anything fossilizing right now. I don't see anything half fossilizing. Hardly. You do hear about things like, for instance, you know, an entire city or whatever got buried over in, Tasmania or whatever, by a volcano, and they go in there and they, you know, like, similar to Mount Vesuvius, yeah. And they find bags of flour completely made of stone, you know, and all sorts of artifacts that are just completely ossified. All right, let me see what else I have here. Here's another example of mineralization and how it can form quickly. Stalactites and stalagmites, they will tell you, are anywhere between tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, or even a million years to form what you see in these caves. What I learned was drip, 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 even over a billion years, doesn't produce the heft. You have to have large amounts of water to get the heft that we see. The drip, drip, drip does nothing more than just basically make a long, skinny straw. It doesn't produce the massive cones. Got to have lots of water to do that. And when you have lots of water and a high concentration of mineralization and the right temperatures and everything, these things will form. Now, in France, there's a lot of mineralization, I guess, in different parts of Europe. In France, they have this place where they take items and put them under a little bit of waterfalls, just like, you know, in a cave. The one that we saw there with the teddy bear, that's outside. This is inside. And we asked them, this is a French Coke bottle, okay? This exact same bottle that we asked them to put under their little trickly falls. And this is what it ended up looking like. 6 weeks. No, six weeks, I believe it was. It was either 5 or 6 weeks. And 5 millimeters, or about a quarter of an inch, of accumulation.
That's nuts.
This is the same type of stuff that you're going to see in caves. So it's not time, it's condition. The conditions. The assumption is that the drip, drip, drip has gone on for hundreds of thousands of years. But if there was a worldwide flood and there was a lot of water being sloshed around, whether the intake or the outtake or somewhere, in, you know, slightly after the flood, when things were kind of getting redeposited all over the place, those caves were formed quickly, relatively quickly. Hundreds of years, 1,000 years at the most.
Yeah.
So, no.
He said no.
It's you know what amazing. The bottom line is? And anybody who's watching or listening to this, let me tell you what the bottom line is to this whole discussion. It is either, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, or, and I hope I'm not sounding too facetious, in the beginning, nothing created nothing. But you get what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
It's either, you know, the Big Bang and evolution, or in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. It really boils down to that. You can sit there and talk about science, this, science, that. Science has to be repeatable and observable. And, you know, when we're talking about this type of science, yes, there's science involved. But the very fundamentals of science aren't able to join in with this discussion because you can't observe it and you can't test it. It's not repeatable. And so you got to use historical records as one way to try to help understand what happened. But anyway.
Well, I think you did just show that it can be repeated and it doesn't take that long. So that to me right there is evidence enough. But I think we talk about this and I'm sure Carl Baugh has a replica of that with the, I think it's the Delk print, they call it, with the, it's the dinosaur print over top of the human footprint, where the human footprint had been set down first, and you can see that the dinosaur print had actually kind of gone over part, the lower part of the foot, and you see those together in one place.
That's right.
I mean, that is a really, really, really hard thing to fake if you're going to say that the fossils take that long to be created, but so you can't fake that. But how do you explain away the human foot that's there?
Well, okay. So here's what we know. The matrix that it's in is Cretaceous limestone. Okay. So either it's 100 million years old or it's 4,400 years old, depending on which, you know. If the dinosaur print is true, and the human footprint is true, if it is, let's just give the benefit of the doubt, you got a real big problem. Because either geology is wrong, and both of these were right around the time of the flood, or humans went back as far as 100 million years ago, or dinosaurs were as recent as 1 million years ago. But then again, you're assigning Cretaceous limestone is 100 million years that it's in. You got a lot of problems, no matter where you look at it. So you can discount it by basically saying, look, this was not found in situ. This was not found where it was originally. And it wasn't. It was up on the bank. I've been to the Paluxy. Let me tell you something. I've never seen it storm. I've never seen the surges that come down that river or any of the river. I've never been around a river that's got real violent, but it tears up the sides underneath and just throws these stones all over the place. Maybe you've seen that or evidence of that. But you go to the Biloxi, look on each side of the banks, you're going to see a whole lot of stones just sitting there. And you got to ask the question, how'd they get there? Water flow. So this thing was up on the bank somewhere. So, you know, that doesn't help it by finding it there. And then having a creationist have it doesn't help it either, okay, in one respect. Because there's going to be this natural bias towards it. Okay, well, fine. But it is what it is. Now, one of the ways to prove whether or not a footprint, whether it be human, dinosaur, whatever, you want to see if it's been carved or if it's real, one way to do that is to have it CAT scan done of it. And they do layers and they go through it electronically, x-raying it, to see if there's compression. Now, let me explain what that means. Here's the dinosaur print. When the dinosaur foot comes down, it presses the mud underneath the foot. If you were to slice this and look underneath, you would see compression, evidence of compression, where the mud, like a sponge, has been pressed down. So if you cut it in half and looked at it cross-section, you'd be able to see right underneath, and you'd see whether or not it's compressed. When you fake a print by carving it out, you can't carve into it compression. It's impossible.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way. It may not be it may not be 100%, but I'm just saying, though, that that's one way they use. The other is, like in the Delk print, the Acrocanthosaurus, they believe, it was a theropod, a three-toed dinosaur. One of the toes is pushing into the human footprint. So the human footprint, which is about 10 and a half inches, comes down. And then the dinosaur print comes down near it, and its big toe or middle toe has pushed itself slightly into the bank. I'll call it the bank of the side of the foot. So mud up push is, I don't know if that can be really replicated via a good sculptor, but mud had to be soft in order to do that. And then it hardened. So yeah, most creationist organizations have rejected this. What's that?
And all the stories, and you know, you have all these stories of dragons and people slaying dragons. So you have these dinosaur, you know, described creatures being around the time of man, and man having to kill these things. You know, of course, the population was very low, and there was just remnants of them left. And then, you know, you go down into South America and Peru, you got the Inca stones, these stones carved. It shows people riding them like horses and using them to pull and move stone and things like that. And you've even shown, I've seen on your channel, there's medieval paintings that if you zoom in close enough, you see people riding these things like horses, riding a velociraptor.
There's actually stories. If you go, and it's, I believe it's in the about 14th or 15th century in China, where there's a set family that would raise dragons to pull the emperor's carriage. And that family, I can't remember which dynasty it was, but that family, that was their job. And they have depictions of this where these dinosaurs, dragons, whatever you want to call them, are pulling these carriages. And it just, there's so much of that throughout history. They haven't been able to suppress all of those things. And that comes up a little bit. I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
No, you just inspired a thought here. You know, on their calendar, they have a rat and a monkey and everything, and they have a dragon. And it's like, is that mythical? I mean, all the other ones are real.
Yeah.
And the dragon is very, very important to the Chinese.
So they
would have a mythical creature among all the others. I mean, you can make the argument that that was real. Some facsimile of it was, you know, resembling that was real.
A little bit of hyperbole involved in it, but it was based on a actual animal.
That makes sense. It doesn't make sense if you believe in long ages and that the dinosaurs died out in 65 million years ago, then it makes no sense whatsoever. It's all nonsense. And it's just you Christians trying to prove your point by grasping at anything.
Now, so the part, and that we talked about this a little bit the other day, John, and this is something that fascinates me. And, you know, I always, you know, as a child, you know, you sit there and think dinosaurs, man, that'd have been awesome. You know, Jurassic Park was one of my favorite movies because you got to see the most real depiction of dinosaurs as much as, you know, obviously they're Hollywood versions of what they potentially believe they could have been or just to scare you. But I always, you know, thought about it. Okay. If this is true and dinosaurs weren't just the result of sin, if they were truly, you know, on the ark and they come through, if we look at prior to flood, the conditions you talked about giant humans, we talked about things being, you know, larger stature because of multiple different reasons, but environmental factors, we'll say right. That. So dinosaurs are bigger at that time. We get rid of those environmental factors, whether that's a vapor canopy or whatever it is prior to the flood, we get afterwards, man doesn't live as long. We're shorter. We're not as resilient. Animals all become smaller. And you can see that in some of the other fossils when we talk about even the mammal fossils that we see, that are much bigger animals. And then we come along
everything's
further.
Bigger.
No, everything was bigger. So now we have everything that's kind of downsized, right? So maybe this rhinoceros that's extinct isn't really extinct. It's just a smaller rhinoceros now, right? So we have all these things that we see as we go down the line. And then you have, if you go to places that are a lot less explored, if you go to the Congo, if you go to different parts of, there's a lot of different parts of Africa that are as untouched as any other place in the world. And there's stories of the Mokle Mbembe, which is like a sauropod type dinosaur that, and they'll take these pictures into these people and say, oh, is it an elephant? Is it a this? And they will instantly point to the picture of the dinosaur. That's what it is. Wow. And they see these and they know that's what it is. There's all sorts of different tribes in there that will describe something like a stegosaurus, that will describe something like an Allosaurus in these different places deep in these jungles where this stuff's hidden. It wasn't even that long ago where they found that cave in China that has a whole separate ecosystem, biggest cave in the world, that was way back, way, way back in there. It has a whole separate ecosystem down in the ground. It has a huge opening. It goes up, but down there's all these different things that people didn't even know about. And it's these things are hidden from us. You know, we think we know everything. As
hollow earth
is huge. Well, we just did a show on talking about some of
Godzilla
that stuff.
Godzilla down there.
But, you know, there's so many things that we think we're so smart. We think we have it all figured out, but there's so much more in our world that God has put here just to prove his greatness that is everywhere. It's just so amazing to me that we can just sit there. No, we've seen it all. Now we got to go to space. Now we got to go to Mars or something like this. We don't even know what 90% of our oceans. We still don't even have any clue, let alone still the actual land we can go on. There's just places you just can't get to. It's just so cool to me. There's actually a story too. I'm just going to throw this last one in there. And I want to say it was Tony Merkel's show where he was talking to a Native American gentleman. And he said his grandfather would tell him stories. They lived up in the area around the Badlands. And his grandfather would tell him stories about how when he was a child, his father took him out and they would go through the Badlands to these different areas and look down over these valleys and watch the different herds of dinosaurs move through the Badlands. And he said that the Native American names for those dinosaurs were what they called each individual valley. And I mean, this is stuff that has been suppressed from us. This is all knowledge that's out there, but it's, you got to go to the cultures, right? You got to go to the Native American cultures. You got to go to the, you know, the Chinese, go back into their roots and their culture and into those further back dynasties. You see how much that the dragons were venerated, but they were very real things. You see that throughout all these different world cultures, just like we see the flood story in every world culture. There is a flood story. There is hundreds of flood stories in every different culture. It's there. So how do we disprove all of that? How do we disprove the flood when every culture prior to our what we call today mainstream science is the only one that doesn't want to go with that?
Well, you know, there was a woman from the 1800s that said, a very spiritual woman, she said that the reception of truth has more to do with the heart than the mind. And I believe that's true. Mm-hmm. It's not a mind thing. It's not a logic thing. It's a heart thing at the very root of it. And that's the reason why when I was 20 years ago, when I was on a skeptic forum, when I first launched this thing called Bibleland Studios in the Lost World Museum, too, prior to that, I asked somebody on there, I said, let me ask you this. What would you say if they found a 5,000-year-old, 500-foot-long wooden ship 15,000 feet on top of Mount Ararat? What would you say then? Do you know what he said? He said he says nothing. He says there would be a 5,000-year-old ship on top of Mount Ararat.
That's heart
pasture.
That's
all he said. That's all that he could say about that.
Yeah, I want to quote this verse. You said that, and it brought up this verse that I always was drawn to, especially when we started this show. I think like in our first season, I quoted it a few times, but I forgot. I had to search it up. But it's Proverbs chapter 1, starting verse 20. It says, wisdom crieth aloud in the streets. She uttereth her voice in the broad places. She crieth in the chief places of concourse, at the entrance of the gates in the city. She uttereth her words. How long, ye simple ones, will ye love simplicity? And scoffers delight them in scoffing, and fools hate knowledge. It's a matter of the heart.
It is
100%.
I get daily doses of that on my sites. Usually when people open up a social media site, they like to have people like them and approve of them. But I would say that anywhere between 70 to 90% of all the comments that I get are people who say you're an idiot and
trolls.
Variations of that. Absolutely. Absolutely. For a while, there was a little bit of, I was able to sustain it. Then I just was getting bombarded really heavily. I was going into other social media sites, and after a while, it was starting to get to me because I didn't want to retaliate. I did want to, but I didn't. I chose not to do that. And but now I don't know if I'm jaded. I don't care anymore. I don't know, but it's just what they do. I mean, I still care. And it's nice when people are polite, but it's very, here's something I'll tell you about talking about a crime scene investigation. Here's what's very, very interesting. Out of the 20 years that I have been interfacing with people on this subject, I can only count out of the hundreds, maybe thousands and thousands of people that I've either read their comments or have had dialogue with them in one way or another, must be in the thousands. I can only, if I could name them by name, maybe 10 people who disagreed with me who were polite out of the thousands and thousands, maybe 10, maybe. It's such a minority. There seems to be this intense desire, antagonism. They are rude and they belittle. And they try to intellectually stomp you, and they try to intimidate you through intellectualism and the way they orate or write. And it's very telling because my understanding is when you're debating somebody, the first person who starts throwing insults is usually the person who has the weaker position.
Yep.
I find that very interesting. And yet they won. They won the fight. They win.
Liberals.
They're still wrong, but they win.
They run out of talking points, so then they start screaming and calling you names and you're a racist and everything else. But with that, man, there's two reasons, in my opinion, that they act that way. it's a spiritual thing. You're upsetting the entity behind that person pulling their strings, even if it's unbeknownst to them.
That's a good
and
point.
And then number two, it's social media. Mike Tyson said it best. People's gotten too comfortable with being keyboard warriors and being disrespectful and not getting punched right square in the mouth. I'm saved and I'm a Christian, but I'm saved. I ain't soft. You disrespect me, you better be a badder man than me or can run faster, because I'm gonna try to knock some teeth out.
He's right about that. It does create that anonymity that gives you the freedom to be able to say whatever you want and whatever attitude you want to display it, you know, on the keyboard.
Because 90% of those people will not say those things to your face.
No, it's just the way it works like that. But on the keyboard, yeah. The one thing that does disturb me, there's two things that disturb me just a little bit, other than arrogance. When they say that I'm hurting children, it doesn't bother me as much anymore, but it did when they first, they don't say it very often, but I've had, you know, that young earth creationism hurts children, you know, and it's just the opposite.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that. And the other thing that kind of gets me is when somebody who's claims to be some born again Christian attacks me. I find that very ironic. And that does bother me a little bit more than the atheist.
So I'll say one thing, and this is my stance on this all the time, because we see it a little bit, not as much as you do, I'm sure, but we see it sometimes. But I will always say anger comes from conviction. So the minute that something offends you, you feel it because you're convicted. You know, when it says that Jesus stands at the door and he knocks, he's knocking on your heart, right? As soon as you feel conviction in you, all of a sudden you have a choice. Either you can open up to that, or you can fight it as strong as you want. You can deadbolt that door, you can lock that door, you can shout at that person to get away from your door. And is that exactly what Justin was talking about? Ephesians 6:12, right? We don't fight against flesh and blood. There is something behind those people. We're fighting an evil entity. It's a supernatural spiritual war. Spiritual warfare is very, very real. It is right there behind you. It is all around you. And the goal of those supernatural entities is to tear down those who are pushing the word of God. That's their whole goal. So the more flack you get, that means you're doing something good. The harder that they come at you, that means you're doing what's right. And I'll also say to that same point that, oh man, I was going really somewhere good with this.
Yeah.
I was going somewhere good with this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I lost it. My mind went blank. I'll think of it in a minute. Go ahead, John.
Sure. So in 2020, I started doing TikTok. That's where I started getting going at doing this. I learned about TikTok and I got on there and I started doing museum stuff. And I, for 2.5 years, I was doing 5 nights a week. I was doing lives, and you know, it was during that whole COVID thing and everything. And so I'll never forget, early on when I was doing a live, you know, you can comment when somebody's doing a live. Somebody said, "Hail Satan." So when you're dealing with the secular public, and I was the secular public, okay? So I know what it is to be a secular person. And I said, "You got to think on your feet quick." And I just said, "Well, hey, the person who just said, 'Hail Satan,' welcome to the channel." When I share that at church, people don't know what to think when I say that somebody said, "Hail Satan." They think that's like, you know, you can't do that. Yeah, I welcomed them right in. Come on in, you know.
Yeah. It's like kids doing really outlandish stuff, just looking for a reaction.
Oh, they do. If I was 18 years old, I'd be on there saying, "Hail Satan, everybody." I was a terrible instigator.
Yep.
I would have been terrible. I'm glad I didn't have this technology when I was 18.
Oh my gosh.
I would have done with it.
Now, I get, so what I was going to say before, kind of going on the same path, is that you sit here and you can say, okay, say that 90% of your reactions are negative. say it's people that are feeling that conviction, people that are coming at you, people that are saying these negative things or trying to disprove what you say or say, well, you know, I heard this, and they've never done the research. They've never looked into it themselves. They're standing on the shoulders of somebody else who they were taught in high school or whatever else. But if you make a difference, just like you talked about that you were in that secular stage at one point and somehow one day it clicked. What if you're the one person that person's coming at you over and over and over again for a month? Then all of a sudden one day they're like, holy crap, he's right. Guess what? Everything that you've ever done to this point was worth it. Everything that you've done just for that one, everything was worth it. And I guarantee it's more than one that you've come to that point where you've hit somebody and they're like, well, holy cow, he's right. And it just hit him. And you know what? In the end, you might not hear that. They might not come and say, man, thank you very much for that. But it's those things that God looks at us, you know, when we get up there, you know, well done, my good and faithful servant, all that. He's going to be there, pat you on the back, say, hey. And then some guy will walk up to you in heaven and say, buddy, thank you so much. And it'll all be worth it. So we got to put up with the negative because that means we're doing what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, you meet the devil face to face, it means you're walking in the same direction, brother.
Mm-hmm.
So I was doing a live, and my wife was on with me, and she was reading the comments as I was doing my thing, and somebody was being a troll, you know, and all of a sudden, and the way I was interacting with, I think him, in his trollness, you know, he said, you know, I was getting on here to troll. Oh, no, we weren't interacting, but he got on there to troll us, to do something stupid, say some stupid stuff. And he goes, but I kind of like you guys. So there is a minority of winning people over by maintaining, and I get it from people like, man, you Christians will DM me, not very often. And they'll say, I wouldn't have been as patient with that guy as you did. I have to force myself sometimes to be patient because I can't retaliate. That's not part of this this program. That's not part of this ministry as much as I want to. I've written a couple of texts, you know, comments back and then deleted them. I'm sure everybody's done that. But there was a time when I was on TikTok and somebody got on there and said something rude to me. And I was nice to them back. He ended up DMing me, introducing himself to me, and I'll give you his name. His name was David Smalley. David Smalley is one of the top 10 atheists in the world, I guess. At least that's what he said. Super smart. He has his own podcast and his own Patreon and all that. This was about 3 years ago. He asked me on his show. Just being nice to him got me to get on his atheistic show and one-on-one have a discussion. And he was very fair. He's a former Christian. And he fights for atheism. And so we had a nice long conversation on his program.
That's and a pretty hopeless fight.
Yeah. But he was pretty good about it. Huh? What's that?
Where's the hope in that? You're fighting for nothing. No purpose. No divine image.
I ended up really liking the guy. I really clicked with him. You know, it's funny how that can happen. Mm-hmm. The chemistry can be just right, even if the philosophy is off 180 degrees. But so anyway, yeah. I'm going to show you one more thing, okay?
Absolutely.
And then I got to split, if that's okay, guys.
Yeah, we're good, brother.
Okay.
Make like a leaf and split. Or that's a banana.
All right, I'm going to show you two quick things.
The leaf leaves.
This is a replica. This is a third generation replica of the world famous coal pot and coal.
Mm-hmm.
And this was found in 1912. Two men were at a power station, had a big, huge chunk of coal, broke it in two. The pot falls out, this iron pot. Carl Baugh owns it. I've held it. photographed it, videoed it. It is this size, just to kind of give you an idea. It's about maybe 3.5 inches, 4 inches across. And it was found in coal. Well, if they were telling the truth, coal is approximately 300 million years old, according to evolution. And that shouldn't have been in there. So the two men were either lying, or maybe that was a little cup that Tubal-Cain created in his smith shop and was caught up during the worldwide flood and got, you know, into a bunch of trees that got compressed and got turned into coal, and this along with it. Years later, he felt the need to go before a notary. I've got it on the back here, 1948. So we're talking 36 years later. He says, while I was working in the municipal electric plant in Thomas, Oklahoma in 1912, I came upon a solid chunk of coal, which was too large to use. I broke it with a sledgehammer. This pot fell from the center, leaving the impression or mold of the pot in the piece of coal. And no, we do not have the pieces of the coal. Wish we did. Jim Stull, an employee of the company, witnessed the breaking of the coal and saw the pot fall out. I traced the source of the coal and found that it came from the Wilburton, Oklahoma mines. Signed, Frank Kennard, sworn to me in Sulphur Springs, Arkansas, 27th day of November, 1948, Julia Eldred, Notary Public, Benton County.
That's so cool.
Carl Baugh, in an interview, told me that they found traces of coal at the bottom of the inside the cup, traces of it. That's kind of interesting. I'm going to show you one more thing. This one is, I kind of panned this when I first, this is a replica. What looks like a boot heel, moccasin heel. I'll show you the original photograph. And as you can see demonstrated, it looks like it's a stripped off sole and a boot, or it could be a moccasin, or it could be just a natural formation. So, you know, the critics say, oh, that's ironstone. Ironstone has all sorts of squiggly lines and stuff. So I got some ironstone to see what that was like. Here's what ironstone looks like. It's like, okay, good point. You know, maybe this is, you know, this kind of, you know, thing. But when you look at this, you know, does it look more like this?
Yeah.
Or does it, you know, I mean, I know this is not the correct way of, this is not this, but.
Yeah, that other one's too random.
Yeah. And it was found in 1917. In Las, right in the in Nevada, and sure enough, in 1922, it says imprint of Triassic shoe may change method of estimating world's age.
Now, out of curiosity, was that ever? Did they do a CT of that to find that there was a pressure from the actual foot being pushed down the same way as the other one?
No, they didn't. I hunted this down and got some micro photographs of it that they took in 1929 at the Carnegie Institute in New York. This does exist. They don't know where it is.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
They tried to find it so I could get some new digital prints of it, you know, but it is in the hands of some historical society. So,
well,
before. Yeah.
Go ahead. No, you go ahead.
I just want to give to your listeners or to your viewers, I got a free report. It's called The 3 Top Reasons Why Noah's Ark Must Still Exist. And it's free. And I'm going to put this up there. I don't know if it's in reverse vision or not, but it's museumalerts.com. So for those of you that are listening, just go to museumalerts with an S, ALERTS.com. And you can get the free Noah's Ark report. So there you have it.
Awesome. Now tell everybody the website where they can find your books, because I'm going to go there as soon as we get off here, I think.
Okay. www.lostworldmuseum.com, and then just go ahead and click on the store and you can take a look at what we have.
Well, man, John, thank you so much for coming on, brother. This was awesome. I got a feeling we may talk to you again in the near future, but I appreciate your time, and thank you again so much.
Thank you, guys. Appreciate it. Thank you, listeners or watchers out there. Take care.
And everybody else out there,
keep digging, baby.
We thank you for listening to the Dig Bible Podcast. Questions, comments, or future episode ideas? We'd love to hear from you at thedig423@gmail.com. If you enjoy our content, don't forget to share, subscribe, and check out our Facebook group at The Dig Podcast. Remember, you can't lean on a shovel and pray for a hole. You gotta dig.